Good morning, everyone, and welcome to CSIS. I'm Bonnie Glazer, and I'm a senior fellow with the Freeman Chair in China Studies. We have a really terrific program this morning. Chinese foreign policy has been the focus of much attention recently, and I think the most commonly used adjective to describe Chinese foreign policy in recent days and weeks in the media has been assertive. And there are many examples that we can cite, looking back to last year when Chinese ships impeded the passage of U.S. ocean surveillance vessels in the South China Sea, or the rhetorically assertive response to the announcement of arms sales to Taiwan in January of this year, and strong objections by the Chinese government to the possible deployment of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Yellow Sea after the sinking of the South Korean vessel, the Chonan. And in recent weeks, we saw a fairly tough reaction from the Chinese government after the Japanese Coast Guard arrested the captain of a Chinese vessel that had rammed a Japanese Coast Guard ship, including suspending high-level exchanges and reports of halting the export of rare earth minerals to Japan. Understanding Chinese foreign policy has been extremely challenging due to the fact that decision-making in China is very opaque, very, very difficult to analyze what the decision-making system is like and how it works. But another complicating factor that has emerged in recent years is the proliferation of interest groups and new actors that are influencing foreign policy in new ways, including the military, large Chinese companies, and public opinion that reflects growing nationalism and also anti-foreign sentiments. To help us understand this complex issue, we have three leading experts on China with us this morning. The first is Linda Jakobsen, and she will be presenting a new paper that she has written called New Foreign Policy Actors in China, which I recommend to all of you. Linda is the director of the Program on China and Global Security at SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace and Research Institute. And following Linda's presentation, we will have two discussants. Erica Downs is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Thornton Center on China Studies, where she specializes on energy. And then she will be followed by David Finkelstein, who is vice president of the Center for Naval Analysis and director of the CNA China Studies Program. So we will start first with Linda Jakobsen.
Thank you, Bonnie. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to first thank CSIS and especially Bonnie Glazer for inviting me here today. It's an honor. It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. I'd like to mention my co-author, Dean Knox, who is at the moment somewhere exploring the grasslands of Inner Mongolia, taking advantage of the Chinese National Day holiday, and not with us here today. I'm very happy to see so many familiar faces in the audience. I'm especially pleased that my brother-in-law, Colonel Kevin Lanzett, a longtime China watcher, my nephew, Adam Jakobsen, are also with us. This new SIPRI report examines, as Bonnie already mentioned, the emergence of these new interest groups, these new foreign policy actors in China. Now, there are new influential actors both within the official decision-making apparatus of China, that is the Communist Party, the government, the People's Liberation Army, and there are also various new groups on the margins, as we call them in our report. For example, within the Chinese bureaucracy, the Chinese Foreign Ministry is today merely one actor in the realm of foreign policy and not necessarily the most important one. The number of official actors ranges widely from issue to issue, but can include institutions as varied as, for example, the CCP Policy Research Office, the Government's National Development and Reform Commission, or the PLA Second Artillery Corps. As to the actors on the margins, in other words, those which are outside the traditional confines of the party and government, we identify as the most important ones businessmen, especially CEOs of large state-owned enterprises in the resource sector, local governments, especially local leaders in the border and coastal regions, prominent researchers and intellectuals. These intellectuals have, for one reason or another, good and strong ties to top leaders. And then, lastly, prominent media representatives and the online community. We lump them together with the word netizens. I think that we all know that the pluralization of Chinese society today, the growing interdependence of China with the rest of the world, are putting enormous pressures on the leaders of the Communist Party of China. The party leaders rely on a host of interest groups to stay in power. What does that mean? It means that they need these interest groups to maintain social order and ensure continued economic growth. As a result, the leadership needs to accommodate numerous and sometimes quite competing agendas. This challenge is further complicated by the decentralization of power which has taken place over the past three decades and has been absolutely essential to China's economic success story. Hence, consensus building within the party Politburo, the all-powerful and highly secretive decision-making body, is important to ensure CPC unity and also, of course, political stability. Of the new foreign policy actors, without question, the most dynamic are the netizens. The internet and the commercialization of the media in China have quite dramatically transformed the interaction between officials and citizens today. People in China are permitted to express their views both on opinion pages in newspapers and on the internet more freely than anyone could imagine just perhaps 10 years ago. The perspectives, the sources of information available to any ordinary citizen have definitely multiplied. This does not mean that citizens have a freedom of expression. The authorities still do their utmost to steer public opinion, sometimes by encouraging a certain stance on any given issue, and sometimes by suppressing public opinion when it is deemed detrimental to whatever the government's objectives are. Although the online community expresses a wide range of views, as they do in any country, there are also moderate ones. There are also pro-Western ones in China. One can say that national sentiment is definitely prevalent, and at times can escalate to the absolute extremes. Blog writers on popular sites dealing with foreign affairs often criticize Chinese leaders for being too weak. They criticize them for bowing to international pressure, especially pressure from the West. Chinese officials are acutely aware that this dissatisfaction with the way foreign policy is handled can give rise to the questioning of the leadership's overall capability to govern. So leaders' actions are, we conclude in the SIPRI report, at times constrained by public opinion, especially the views of the online community during an international crisis involving China. And this is especially relevant when the United States or Japan is involved, or when international attention focuses on any issue related to Taiwan or Tibet, as we saw, for example, in Europe when the Olympic torch relay led to a lot of demonstrations and extreme nationalist comments on the internet in China some months before the Beijing Olympic Games. So there are omnidirectional influences at play. between CPC officials, government officials, PLA officers, intellectuals, researchers, businessmen, and the media. Everyone is trying to see influence each other and also trying to influence public opinion at the same time. They lobby, they write blogs, they take part in televised debates, and they engage in all sorts of researcher roundtable discussions pertaining to Chinese foreign policy. Certainly, the participation of businessmen and PLA officers in these discourses is a phenomenon that didn't exist 10 to 15 years ago. I think that awareness of these omnidirectional channels of influence is quite critical for us foreigners when we try and understand these very complex foreign policy decision-making processes in China. It's no longer possible to think about China's decision-makers as a unitary force on any given foreign policy issue. Those seeking China's cooperation need to evaluate a whole host of potential interests from various interest groups. It's also, I think, critical to take into consideration this nationalist undercurrent running throughout China and the possibly constraining effect that this sentiment has on leaders' room for maneuver, especially during a crisis. From our analysis of the new foreign policy actors, three broad trends are evident, and I thought I'd, in the rest of my time here, just concentrate on these trends, as I know that the PLA and the energy companies will be discussed more in detail by my discussants. First, in foreign policy decision-making, authority has become fractured. Second, while in general China's continued internationalization is regarded by all actors, both official ones and unofficial ones, as inevitable, there are certainly varying views among both the official and the marginal actors regarding the degree to which China should more should prioritize internationalization in its development. And then thirdly, the view that China should more actively defend and pursue its interests internationally is becoming prevalent, especially among the new foreign policy actors. And of course, each of these trends have implications for policymakers abroad. The first trend, the fracturing of authority in foreign policy formulation. I think it's, without question, forced the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to share power. A majority of the CIPRI interviews, I did over 70 interviews in China for this report, regarded the MFA as a weak actor. Within the government, one can say that the Ministry of Commerce, the National Development and Reform Commission, the People's Bank of China, the China Development Bank are all looked upon as very influential foreign policy actors. Other ministries and other CPC organs also vie for their voices to be heard. And I think that this trend will accelerate as China's share of the global economy grows and domestic considerations increasingly have foreign policy ramifications. This means that decisions by even the lesser ministries, so to speak, will have an impact on countries both near and far. Now, due to a lack of information, the roles of the PLA and the Ministry of State Security are certainly the most difficult to assess. Several CIPRI interviewees said that the Beijing Olympics and then the riots in Xinjiang last summer have led to more funds and prestige for the Ministry of State Security, thereby making it an increasingly powerful domestic actor whose sway spills over into the foreign policy realm. We know certainly that this ministry is a strong advocate of the government investing more in information technology to ensure that the state strengthens its intelligence gathering capacity. Now for the PLA. I'll say just a few words on this, and I'm sure Dave Finkelstein and I will then discuss it later from varying viewpoints. The extent to which the PLA has been distanced from foreign policy decision-making is debated inside China. So it's not only debated here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, it's a hot topic also in China. There are certainly Chinese experts who consider the PLA a re-emerging player, but there are also others who do not. For example, at the CPRI China and Global Security program launch in Stockholm about 18 months ago, Jinsan Rong, a prominent scholar in China, said publicly that those guys in uniform should now be thought of as a new foreign policy actor. Even though, of course, the PLA has always been an official actor, but after decades of institutional reform, the PLA has at least officially been distanced from official decision-making processes. Without question, as I mentioned, PLA officers now participate in the public debate, and this is indeed a new phenomenon. They come to civilian workshops, they invite civilian researchers, both Chinese and foreigners, to their own workshops, they take part in televised debates about foreign policy, and so on. They're certainly trying to influence the other actors, both the official ones and the ones on the margin, about foreign policy formulation. Whether or not they have an impact is debatable. But as Bonnie Glaser already mentioned, the PLA certainly no longer shies away from displaying its power, as is evident from numerous incidents and also the 2007 anti-satellite test. And these were actions that the Chinese knew quite well would antagonize both the United States and its neighbors. Beyond the official establishment, the activities of several groups on the margins have a bearing on foreign policy. Some of these actors, for example, local governments with international economic ties, researchers, media figures, netizens, and the general public, at least segments of them, they are actively trying to influence foreign policy. But then there are other actors who do not necessarily want or seek a role in foreign policy, but they nevertheless often end up complicating Chinese diplomacy. For example, large enterprises that primarily would like to pursue commercial interests, just like companies everywhere in the world, but inadvertently entangle foreign policy officials into a web of human rights, energy security concerns, and political interests by their actions. And quite, I think, ironically, of the various peripheral groups that the CPRI report identifies, it's these enterprises that at times affect foreign policy the most, as has been the case recently in Central Asia, Iran, and Sudan. So then to the implications of this fracturing of authority. I think, quite simply put, foreigners need to take into account multiple actors who have both a stake and a say in decision-making processes on any given issue. For example, on climate issues, foreigners couldn't possibly only discuss China's position on international climate talks with the MFA, but they have to involve a host of actors, including the NDRC, the Ministry of Environment, the Ministry of Land and Resources, the Ministry of Science and Technology, and so on. I think awareness of rivalries and overlaps in jurisdiction is key to many forms of cooperation with Chinese partners. The second trend that emerges from our analysis in the CPRI report is the diversity of approaches in China's internationalization. MOFCOM, local governments, large companies, and segments of the research and online communities are strongly in favor of prioritizing China's internationalization. They certainly stand to benefit from it. Free trade agreements, regional development projects, greater investment opportunities, these are all on the agenda of the internationalists. However, while there's no group that opposes the leadership's decision to continue China's engagement with the rest of the world, there are certainly foreign policy actors who support it with caveats. The NDRC, for example, is very wary of an over-reliance on world markets and views any issue that relates to China's foreign policy in terms of the benefits that it brings to economic development, especially energy security. The Ministry of State Security is concerned that too much internationalization will lead to an acceptance of Western values among Chinese citizens, and that in turn would weaken the CCP's ability to manipulate discourse on many topics such as accountability, human rights, and transparency. Segments of the PLA and the online and research communities, in turn, I would say, worry that too far-reaching engagement will lead to China's leaders making compromises with foreign leaders on territorial disputes and issues of sovereignty. I think it's very important that we outsiders recognize these nuances in Chinese perspectives on China's internationalization and, of course, acknowledge that we're not dealing with a monolithic state or even a static engagement strategy. Actors cannot also be categorized along engagement or anti-engagement lines. For example, the NDRC favors buying oil at the well, but it also wants to strengthen collaboration with oil-consuming countries to ensure a very stable world market. Then the third trend is the relatively widespread consensus among especially the new foreign policy actors that China should simply defend its interests more actively by defining rules of international engagement. For example, MOFCOM, the People's Bank of China, numerous leading economists, and numerous netizens as well, advocate that China should demand more or greater voting rights in the International Monetary Fund. Those who want China to assume a more proactive foreign policy are at odds with the more conservative officials who believe that China should not stray from Deng Xiaoping's advice that was to lie low and avoid a leadership role in the international arena. I think in essence, and I've been asked this many times, I think that the present leadership would very much like to continue to take Deng's advice, but they did, or Hu Jintao did, acknowledge the wishes and the desires of the new foreign policy actors last year in August when he conceded that China should actively get something accomplished on the global stage. So I think it is a tug and pull going on between the present leadership and perhaps what we can see is the next leadership of China. Among leading researchers and intellectuals, there are certainly those who support China taking more responsibility in tackling global problems such as climate change, nuclear non-proliferation, IPR issues, and so on. But I would say that these constitute a minority. The mainstream view among both old and new actors is that the calls by industrialized nations to for China to contribute more to global public goods are all an attempt to slow China's rise. In public, of course, Chinese officials avoid direct mention of any suspicions that exist. But, of course, this skepticism is manifested in the continued emphasis by Chinese leaders in these statements that China is still a developing country and China has the right to develop. More broadly, within all emergent interest groups, there are voices that urge China to take a less submissive stance towards the demands by industrialized countries. They would like China to more vigorously defend its right to set conditions when others, especially the United States and Europe, seek China's cooperation on a number of initiatives, such as reducing carbon emissions, sanctioning Iran and North Korea, and so on. Of course, among these conditions are the promise not to sell Taiwan arms, recognition of what some interest groups now view as China's core interests in the South China Sea, a promise by heads of state and government not to meet the Dalai Lama, and so on. The growing perception among Chinese that leaders should more staunchly defend national interests certainly has several implications for foreigners. On the one hand, only by persistently engaging China and involving it in international decision-making processes can we hope to dispel the suspicions that Chinese have about industrialized nations seeking to slow down China's rise. We also want to avoid China being or becoming an aggrieved outsider in the international order. But on the other hand, engaging China does not mean giving it a carte blanche to set the agenda alone. The quid pro quo approach, which was sought by the Chinese government following the U.S. announcement of arms sales this year in January, I think will remain an enormous challenge for Western leaders. If China's economic, political, military might continues to increase, it's going to have even more leverage in its dealings with other powers, both small ones and large ones. So these three trends, fractured authority, varying views of how China should internationalize, and demands that China defends its core interests, are certainly changing the nature of Chinese foreign policy formulation and the way in which China interacts with the rest of the world. Although the decision-making processes remain remain opaque, very secretive, there's lots that we really don't know, I think that this growing influence of new foreign policy actors is bringing a degree of pluralism into foreign policy formulation. And these changes are compelling the CPC leadership to consider and also perhaps balance a broader range of interests much more than they had to before. Because if the party does not balance these interests, it's going to risk losing the loyalty of very vital elites. And in that way, it would jeopardize the support that the CPC needs to rule. I'll stop there. Thank you. And I look forward to comments.
Thank you so much, Linda. Terrific, comprehensive presentation. I think it's a testament to your report that we have such a large crowd here today, and I want to apologize to everybody who is standing in the back in advance of a 3-day weekend. I think we did not anticipate that we would really have such a large turnout. But if people who are standing actually outside the room want to come in, there is space along the wall. If you want to stand along here, if you could move aside and maybe let some people in so at least they can see the speakers, since we don't have an overflow room with a TV today. We will now turn comments first by Erica Downs, who will speak about the role of energy companies in China, one of the new actors in Chinese foreign policy.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Bonnie mentioned, my task is to talk about the role that China's national oil companies, or NOCs, play in Chinese foreign policy. So what I'd like to do with my allotted time is to provide some examples of how China's NOCs appear to have both unintentionally and intentionally impacted foreign policy. Both of these forms of impact are discussed in Linda's report, and both are very difficult to gather information on. Now, when I talk about China's national oil companies unintentionally impacting foreign policy, I'm referring to the company's narrow pursuit of their commercial interests abroad, inadvertently creating challenges for Chinese diplomats. And when I talk about China's NOCs intentionally impacting foreign policy, I'm referring to the company's deliberate efforts to seek to influence Chinese foreign policy to protect and advance their commercial interests abroad. So first, I'd like to turn to the issue of China's national oil companies and their unintentional influence on foreign policy. And I have three examples, some of which are mentioned in passing in Linda's report, of how the companies appear to have unintentionally created diplomatic challenges for Beijing. And the first example I'd like to talk about is the case of China National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC's, investments in Sudan. And my bottom line here is that CNPC's operations in Sudan complicated Chinese foreign policies because outside of China, many people viewed those investments as providing Beijing with leverage over Khartoum, and as a result, there was considerable pressure brought to bear on Beijing to use that influence to play a more activist role in trying to resolve the crisis in Darfur. Now, CNPC first went into Sudan in 1995 and had already established itself as the largest investor and producer in Sudan well before the Darfur crisis erupted in 2003. And although the Chinese government initially tried to maintain that business and politics should remain separate activities and publicly stated this position, they soon learned that this was easier said than done. And that's because so many people outside of China viewed CNPC's operations and the oil that CNPC is pumping was pumping in Sudan as both a source of funding that Khartoum could use for its campaign in Darfur and also as a source of some diplomatic support by Beijing for Khartoum. And as the crisis escalated, there was increasing pressure brought to bear on the Chinese government to use its influence over Khartoum to help solve the crisis. And in my view, this crisis contributed to the more activist role that we saw Beijing start to play around 2006, 2007. And specifically what I'm referring to is the efforts of the Chinese government, the successful efforts to help persuade Khartoum to allow a hybrid African Union, UN peacekeeping force into Darfur. Now, the second example of how China's national oil companies' narrow pursuit of their commercial interests has unintentionally created challenges for Chinese diplomacy is the case of China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC's, bid for Unocal back in 2005. And here my bottom line would be that CNOOC's unsolicited bid for the U.S. firm Unocal, after Unocal had already accepted an offer for Chevron, created tensions in the U.S.-China relationship because of the strong opposition to the bid on Capitol Hill. And here again, we have a case where CNOOC was just pursuing its commercial interests. The idea to bid for Unocal was the brainchild of Fu Chengyu, who was the head of CNOOC at the time. And he viewed the acquisition of an American oil company as a way to advance his objective of transforming CNOOC from a national oil company into an international energy company. However, the anti-China sentiment that erupted in Washington, notably in Congress in response to this bid, threatened to create a negative environment for Chinese President Hu Jintao's planned visit to the United States in September 2005. And as a result, the Chinese leadership reportedly asked CNOOC to withdraw its bid for Unocal. That visit, as you know, didn't happen in September because of Hurricane Katrina. And the third example of how the company's narrow pursuit of their commercial interests can create diplomatic headaches for Beijing, when one that's very much in the news today is the case of the Chinese NOC's investments in the Iranian upstream. And here I'd say that the activities of China's NOCs in Iran, which have been undertaken for commercial prices, are creating a diplomatic headache for Chinese diplomats because their continued presence in Iran is subjecting Beijing's diplomacy toward Iran to increasing international scrutiny and pressure. Now, China's NOCs went to Iran for the same reason that companies such as Shell and Total and Statoil and Repsol did, and that's just because Iran contains several huge undeveloped oil and natural gas fields. And when China's NOCs began pursuing major projects in Iran, for example, when the Chinese company Sinopec signed a memorandum of understanding for the Yadavaran oil field back in 2004, most major international oil companies, with the exception of the American firms and BP, were active in Iran. And so I think for the companies, there's also a sense of safety in numbers. However, today, China's NOCs are the only major foreign companies still active in the Iranian oil patch because European and other companies have stopped investing in Iran, and this is due to a combination of factors, including the fact that Iran's a really tough place to do business and pressure from Washington and their home governments. And, of course, we now have we have a lot of new unilateral sanctions against Iran implemented by the United States and other countries that appear to make it likely that these European and other companies aren't going to be resuming their activities in Iran anytime soon. And as a result of all this, officials in Washington and other world capitals are very worried that continued investment by China's national oil companies in Iran will undermine the tighter unilateral sanctions that were implemented in the wake of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1929. And as a result of this, we've seen warnings from Washington to Beijing to get China to try to persuade China to the Chinese leadership to prevent Chinese national oil companies from expanding their investments in Iran, and notably Robert Einhorn, who's the State Department's special advisor for nonproliferation and arms control, has publicly warned China's companies not to backfill projects in Iran that have been vacated by European and other companies. And as a result, it appears that Beijing's effort to balance the multiple competing interests that drive its Iran policy is getting a bit more difficult. So now I'd like to turn attention to the other way that China's national oil companies impact Chinese diplomacy, and this is the companies intentionally influencing foreign policy by trying to lobby senior Chinese officials, members of the Politburo Standing Committee, to adopt policies that advance or protect the company's interests abroad. And first, I'd like to say a few words about China's NOCs as lobbyists. Now, China's national oil companies, and in particular CNPC and Sinopec, are very powerful political actors in China. CNPC and Sinopec, for example, both have full ministerial rank. And even more importantly, their current general managers have very high rankings in the Chinese Communist Party. And we also know from Richard McGregor's new book, The Party, that these companies have red phones that they can use to, directly access Chinese leadership. And we also know that China's NOCs lobby the central government to make domestic policy decisions that benefit their companies. And if you go back and, look at some of one example of this would be on the issue of pricing. And there's been a tremendous amount of coverage of this issue, especially in the Chinese media, about the companies, lobbying the NDRC, lobbying China's top leaders to make adjustments in both oil prices and the oil pricing mechanism for refined oil products that are beneficial to the companies. So I think it's not surprising that the companies would lobby the Chinese government to protect their interest overseas. And I guess I'd also like to add to that over the years that I've been following the foreign investments of China's national oil companies, one thing that I've heard time and again from colleagues in China is that the national oil companies are very good at linking their narrow commercial interests in growing reserves and growing profits to the national interest in energy security. And as Linda mentioned, they certainly have a sympathetic ear in the National Development and Reform Commission. I've also heard, however, this is a topic, I mentioned at the beginning that both of these forms of impact are very difficult to gather information on. This is by far the more difficult of the two. Over the years that I've done research in Beijing, I've heard commentators say, I've heard people that I've spoke to say that, the companies do lobby. Iran has come up multiple times from multiple interviewees as an issue in which the NOCs are lobbying the government, and that certainly makes a lot of sense to me, that the companies have invested a lot of time and money in gaining access to huge fields that they know in the absence of sanctions otherwise probably would have gone to American and other international oil companies. They want to hold on to these fields for the long term, and so it's not surprising that they would be lobbying the government. However, what I don't know is how successful they've been and what they've said or whether or not they've had an impact. And so finally, I guess by way of conclusion, I would say that China's national oil companies are a new actor in Chinese foreign policy to keep an eye on. And as the companies continue to expand abroad, I suspect that their intentional and unintentional impacts on Chinese diplomacy will increase. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica. Terrific presentation and lots of interesting issues to discuss when we get to our the Q&A portion. But before we do that, we will invite Dave Finkelstein to talk about the role of the military in Chinese foreign policy decision-making.
And in a show of solidarity with the people in the back, I shall deliver my remarks standing. So, when Bonnie asked me to participate today, I did so against my better judgment. This is a busy season for all of us, and I did so for two reasons. The first is that I believe Linda has provided our community an incredibly important paper, and it's an honor to be associated with its Washington, D.C. rollout. The second reason I accepted is, I don't know how to put this. Well, if you know Bonnie, you appreciate her powers of persuasion. So what I'd like to do is make some brief comments about Linda's paper writ large and then focus in on the role of the People's Liberation Army. So the first order of business really is to add my voice to the chorus of praise for Linda's effort. I mean, in some 50-odd pages, she has captured many of the most important trends and changes and actors and influences in Chinese foreign policy making as it stands today, and we're all grateful. Equally impressive, she's done so with a healthy respect for the daunting challenges of doing research into this Chinese black box where data is often hard to come by. And when you think about it, in spite of the fact that we've had a relationship with China for 30-odd years, our understanding of how their policymaking process is not something that we should celebrate. As most people in this room understand, this really is something that we're still speculating about. And we've come a long way since Doak Barnett wrote his important book on Chinese foreign policy making in 1985, and analysts in the academy and also in the think tanks and institutes continue to chip away for this. But in the meantime, where does Linda's important work fit in the scholarship? And for me, the answer was crystal clear. I see her paper as an important postscript to Mike Lambton's excellent 2001 edited volume, The Making of Chinese Foreign and Security Policy in the Era of Reform, 1978 to 2000. And here, Linda takes us from 2000 to 2010, an important postscript to that book. And so in many cases, she was able to validate with newly emergent data trends that Lambton and his crew 10 years ago could only suggest. So she has a data-based validation, which, as opposed to shoot-from-the-hip opinion, which, of course, is the special characteristic of Washington. So we're very pleased to have that particular paper join us in the literature. Let me turn now to the People's Liberation Army. And now that I've heard some of the comments and thought about it again, maybe another way to think about the PLA is old actor, new techniques. But let me just make some more formal comments. One of the striking features of Linda's paper is how relatively speculative the section on the PLA is relative to the other actors in the new foreign policy-making process. Now, that is not a criticism. What that is recognition of the reality that the PLA's role is the blackest box within the black box that is this foreign policy making process. And of course, we have some good views and good literature out there. I think Michael Swain's 1996 monograph on the PLA and the military in national security policymaking really was one of the major steps forward in our understanding of how the military and defense establishment in China plays into that policymaking process. But 1996 was a couple of Chinas ago, and I think that China has changed, the PLA has changed, and I think we need to be very careful about how we assess our levels of confidence in what we believe we know about how that military plays in the foreign policy establishment. So in my remaining few minutes, let me, like a lemming rushing to the sea with gay and reckless abandon, put on the table some of my own thoughts on this particular topic, in the full disclosure that my understanding is imperfect and I'm absolutely prepared to be told I am wrong. So I think that analysts would be hard-pressed to find any military anywhere that isn't involved in the foreign policy-making process of their country. It's perfectly natural for the PLA to have a role in the foreign policy-making process, and indeed it has, even before 1949. Even in Red Army days in the 1920s and 30s, the PLA was involved. So, but what role does the PLA have today? Basically, we have questions rather than answers. What role? Can the PLA make major policy decisions on foreign affairs on its own authority? And if so, On what types of foreign policy issues? Don't know. Is the PLA, like many militaries around the world, merely providing inputs for other decision makers to act upon and trying to sway policymakers in addition to executing the policies they've been given? Probably, but still, we don't know. My own instincts are that when it comes to foreign policy decision making, the PLA as an institution is one of several other bureaucratic interest groups that are providing inputs to the process and at times vying with others to sway the decision makers. Why do I lean this way? Two reasons. First, it is probably still the case that the most important non-crisis foreign policy decisions made by today's Chinese leadership still require consensus and coordination at the highest levels. And second, while the PLA can and does act as an interest group lobbying its own parochial agenda, there are probably limits to the lengths it will go to do so, especially after a decision has been made by the top party leadership, because, at least in my view, overall, the party still has control over the PLA. So to be blunt, not that anybody has said this, but to be blunt, I do not see the PLA as a rogue element plying its own foreign policy to the dismay and hand-wringing of civilian party state elite. I don't see that. That's not where I see happening. At the same time, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest that in the past, the PLA has skewered the foreign policy process by virtue of how it reported information, or it has been guilty of foot-dragging in the execution of foreign policy decisions in the past. In the case of the former, skewering the foreign policy process, Linda cites the EP3 incident and anecdotal evidence of how Chinese military intelligence may or may not have reported to the Politburo Standing Committee the actual facts of the incident. In the case of the latter, foot-dragging, I would point to the PLA's reluctance to execute certain activities with the U.S. military back in 1998 after the Clinton-Jiang summits had resuscitated military relations once again. Now, if true, these examples would not necessarily constitute bureaucratic behavior unique to the PLA, and the major point would still hold. So what is that major point? The major point is that it is highly unlikely that the PLA is making major foreign policy decisions on its own, in a vacuum, or in contravention of the desires of the civilian party leadership. I'll throw that out there to be attacked, corrected, and looked at on a case-by-case basis. But in addition, I believe the PLA is one of several actors involved in shaping policy outcomes and at times lobbying for outcomes and at times prevailing. Which ones they are? These are the grist of case studies. Second, as a bureaucratic actor, the PLA certainly has institutionalized venues through which it can make its voice on foreign policy heard. I don't have total visibility on all of them, but I could at least, without any trouble at all, conjure up 10 ways in which the PLA makes its voice heard. Let me go through them quickly. The most important, of course, is through the Central Military Commission, where Hu Jintao is the chairman, and through Hu Jintao, in theory, the PLA's views can go to the Politburo Standing Committee. So we have the Central Military Commission, a party organ, not a PLA organ, a party organ staffed by PLA people. Next, the seats that the PLA has on leading small groups, Lingdao Xiaozu, such as the Foreign Affairs Leading Small Group, the National Security Affairs Small Group, and the Taiwan Affairs Leading Small Group. There may be other leading small groups that the PLA is represented on. If there are, I don't know what they are. Maybe Bonnie or others do. Moreover, there actually remain questions as to whether these leading small groups are coordinating bodies, recommendation-making bodies, decision-making bodies, or all three. Anyway, in either case, the PLA has a role on three critical leading small groups. All right. Third way, analysts agree that the PLA makes its voice heard through the intelligence analyses and the policy papers that the General Staff Department and other national-level PLA entities undoubtedly distribute throughout the party state elite apparatus up through the CMC, at least to Hu Jintao. Now, do these PLA analyses go beyond the military chain of command? Frankly, I don't know. Are they seen by other Buman involved in the foreign policy apparatus, the Xitong? I don't know. But we know that the PLA at the national level, the four general departments, NDU and Academy of Military Science, are providing inputs to the top leadership of the CMC, a party institution. Fourth, Politburo study sessions. One of the bureaucratic innovations under the leadership of Hu Jintao has been study sessions where the full Politburo comes to hear important issues on domestic and foreign affairs, and there are at least two, maybe more cases, at least two that I've seen, documented cases in the public domain, where members of the Academy of Military Sciences were called before the Politburo to give presentations on the nature of modern warfare or other national security issues. So we have that. Fifth, the National People's Congresses provide a venue for PLA communication. Right? In recent years, the PLA delegates have been increasingly vocal and public in articulating the PLA's views on various defense and security issues, many of which have foreign policy implications. It's their way of talking to three audiences: the party leadership, the Chinese people, and the rank-and-file PLA, right? Sixth, defense white papers published by the PLA. The very fact that these white papers, drafted by the PLA, are in fact coordinated across the party-state apparatus causes a conversation to take place among the top leaders of the PLA and others in the foreign policy shitung on China's foreign and security policies and interests. Seventh, anecdotal evidence that over the past few years, desk officers in the PLA are more and more talking to their counterparts at the MFA, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, at Ministry of Foreign Commerce, at NDRC, etc. If that's true, and I believe that it is, that's a significant development for horizontal communication and coordination across the party-state apparatus. Eighth way, very elusive, is the presence of PLA officers in the mainstream media in China. We've seen a lot of that this summer. It's tough to understand where these folks fit. You know, in the Chinese media today, I think of the Chinese media as a rectangle with three horizontal slices. There's the must-have content at the top, the forbidden content at the bottom, and the discretionary content in between. And I don't know where these PLA officers are sitting. I think they're on the line between must-have content and discretionary content. Others are at the line of forbidden content and discretionary content. We don't really know who these people represent. There are a lot of questions about it. But they're out there talking to the public as Linda and the leadership, as Linda suggests. Ninth, in the past, some PLA officers have been assigned to important foreign policy or national security policy mechanisms. One case study, and Bonnie is very conversant in this, in 2003, Lieutenant General Chun Xiaogong was assigned to the Foreign Affairs Office of the Central Committee, which manages both the Foreign Affairs Leading Group and the National Security Affairs Leading Group. What I don't have understanding of is whether he was assigned there as an institutional representation of the PLA or he was just assigned there for personal connections and for the enhancement of his career. But at one point, you had a person there. Which brings us to number 10, 10 ways that I say the PLA can communicate. It's also through the idea of personal connections. Now, in Chinese government, as in every government, personality matters, only perhaps much more so in China, some would say. So at times, analysts have asserted that the PLA has had more potential to influence foreign affairs than is the norm when certain individuals in the PLA had personal connections to the very top party leadership. Now, the classic case is that of Chiang Kai-shek, who was rumored to be very, very close to Jiang Zemin and had Jiang Zemin's ear. So this is a quick and dirty overview of 10 ways in which at least the PLA in the past could have its voice heard in the foreign policy process. Now, there's nothing particularly new or exciting about this, so I'd better conjure up something to justify my invitation. So let me go out on a limb here. In doing so, I'd like to broaden out the discussion beyond just foreign policy making to the issue of national security policy making, especially the external dimensions of China's national security, which, of course, has direct implications for Chinese foreign policy. So here goes. This is potentially brilliant, so pay attention. If it is not happening already, I'd like to suggest that the real possibility that the advisory and consultative role of the PLA on external dimensions of national security is likely to become more sought out by the civilian party elite who make major decisions, and that the advice and consultations of the PLA is likely in the future to become more relevant and more important to China's larger national security objectives. Now, why do I speculate this? Three reasons. First, and Linda's really laid this out very well, China's national interests continue to expand and broaden, and in some cases there is a security or military dimension involved. Simply put, China's global footprint is expanding, and with it, Beijing is encountering security challenges it hitherto did not have to worry about, such as the physical security of its growing expatriate community around the world, the protection of its investments, as Erica pointed out, abroad, and the security of the global transit hubs, maritime and others, upon which China's economic security increasingly depends. Alternately stated, a China with global economic interests is already a China with global political interests and, increasingly, a China with expanding global security interests. Moreover, national security for China is no longer just about traditional threats. It's also about non-traditional security. And both traditional and non-traditional security have a military dimension to them. Witness the PLA's deployment to the Gulf of Aden to fight piracy out there off the Horn of Africa. So that's the first reason, expanding national interests. Second, the PLA is developing pockets of operational capacity it never before had that it could offer to the policymakers as options. Capabilities give you options. The extension of the PLA's Navy's zone of operations offshore into the South, East, and Yellow Seas is a case in point in the realm of traditional security. Now, in the realm of non-traditional security, the PLA Navy recently, for example, launched its first 400-bed hospital ship, the Daishan Dao, which has been deployed to the Gulf of Aden and in throughout the Indian Ocean. So having new capabilities and giving the PRC leadership new options will likely provide more consultative opportunities between the PLA and the decision-makers in the civilian party elite structure. Third reason, that the PLA's consultative space may be improving or expanding. In carrying out its approved military missions, an expanding set of missions, I might add, that was handed down to the PLA by the party leadership, no less than Hu Jintao, the PLA is increasingly involved in activities that have foreign policy and security policy implications, activities that require coordination and consultation across the party state. More than at any time in its history, the PLA is going places and doing things. And I have talked about the last decade and the last couple of years as the period of an incipient expeditionary PLA. The activities of the PLA beyond China's shores really becomes impressive when you count up what's been going on over the last 10 years in three areas. First, the number of UN peacekeeping operations or observer missions the PLA and People's Armed Police have been sent out to accomplish. Second, the number of combined, meaning with a foreign country, combined exercises the PLA now engages with foreign militaries. Incidentally, you may have noticed in the news that the PLA Air Force exercised in Turkey with the Turkish Air Force. I think that's the first time that the Chinese military has exercised with a NATO country in that NATO country. So that has foreign policy implications. You just don't go off and do that without consulting the rest of the foreign policy bureaucracy. And third, with military operations other than war, as what the PLA talks about, such as humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, operations, the anti-piracy operation once again. So it seems to me that these three factors cannot help but raise the profile of the PLA in select niches of the policymaking process relative to the past. Now, finally, and I'm just about done here, Bonnie. It may also turn out to be the case that there is what I'd like to call an expanded bureaucratic operating space in the PRC foreign and security policymaking process that the PLA, just by nature of being so well organized relative to other bureaucracies, can easily fill. What does this mean? This expanded bureaucratic operating space is the result, I believe, of China's external security interests and external national interests outpacing the capacity of its traditional institutional mechanisms to manage those interests. In other words, in a system that has a weak coordination policy mechanism, in a system where you still have a 1960s and 1970s style management for 21st century 21st century requirements, the PLA is going to have a little bit more operating space in between the seams of the bureaucracy in which it can operate. I've gone on long enough. Bonnie's kicking me under the table. She has long legs. Thanks for your comments.
Thank you, Dave. Both informative and entertaining, as I would, of course, expect. We now have about half an hour left for Q&A, and hopefully we will have somebody bringing in some microphones. I will ask the first question, which I will ask of Linda Jacobson. Dave has raised the issue of institutional capacity in China, and I'm curious, since you live in Beijing and speak so frequently to so many of these new actors in foreign policy, what the assessment is today of the adequacy of institutions. We have the Politburo Standing Committee and the Politburo, the Central Military Commission, these leading groups that Dave talked about. In 1998-99, there was an intense debate about the need for a National Security Council, and the outcome of that debate was the creation of this National Security Leading Group that Dave referred to. And so I'm curious about whether there is renewed debate about the need for new institutions and what those new institutions might be, or whether there is assessment that current institutions can somehow be used to manage the challenging expansion of interests that Dave talked about.
Thank you, Bonnie, and thank you also to Eric and Dave for these very insightful comments. To go to the question of institutional capacity, I think the whole debate about the need for a National Security Council continues. It wanes, and then it rises again. Every time there's a crisis, every time China sort of comes under a lot of criticism from abroad about the weak position it is in to handle crises, it stirs up this debate, we need a National Security Council. And then when there's not a crisis and people go on with their everyday life, then it wanes again and then everyone forgets about it. I don't see one being established, at least under the present leadership. I think this is something that could well come up after 2012. As everyone knows, we're entering a very interesting phase with a leadership change expected in 2012. And after that, I think it will be renewed, this whole debate. And I'll take this opportunity to talk about what Dave mentioned, this, the possibility that the PLA would be filling this expanded bureaucratic space, if I'm quoting you right. I think that's a very interesting thought. Something that strikes me whenever I go to any ministry or party organ for any kind of a meeting in China today, and we can talk about whether it's climate change, energy security, or a range of issues, openly to a foreigner, the Chinese official will bemoan the fact that they don't have the capacity or the capability to keep up with developments that are taking place in China's outreach, whatever that might be. We'll just take Africa. The Ministry of Commerce continuously bemoans that they don't have enough Africa experience. They do not know how to deal with events which are going faster than they can put in place, for example, regulations. So they are struggling. I tend to say that it's not only China's success story which has surprised and taken us by surprise, us foreigners by surprise. It's taken the Chinese by surprise, and they're not ready for it. And this, in turn, explains the hesitation that the Chinese leaders, I think very smartly, have in China assuming a greater responsible role in the international arena.
Okay, thank you. Usual rules, please identify yourselves when you ask a question. Please keep it concise, and we'll try to keep the answers concise as well so that we can squeeze in as many as possible. Please bring the microphone up front, Carrie Dumbau.
Thank you. Carrie Dumbau from CNA. I have a question for both Linda and Erica. I can talk to Dave offline anytime. Both of you mentioned, Erica in particular, the lobbying being conducted by Chinese companies, and Linda was talking about how SOEs are becoming more important actors. I'm wondering if you see that there, the possibility of either collusion or competition among these companies with the people that they are lobbying. If it were just one single Chinese oil company, that would be one story. But there are multiple companies. Do you get the sense that there might be competition and that this in turn might lead to pressure for some kind of regulation about how companies represented themselves or operated in front of Chinese leaders?
All right, I'll start. I mean, it's a great question. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to completely answer it because of the opacity involved. As I mentioned earlier, I know that they lobby. I don't know that much about the lobbying activities. But on the issue of I wouldn't be surprised if you do have different companies lobbying different senior leaders, in part maybe because of historical relationships. As we heard earlier, relationships do matter. Are there certain energy or mineral company executives that have better relationships with certain senior leaders than others? And we also know that there's a lot of competition between Chinese companies at home, and we also see that abroad. And in general, I think sort of understanding the relationships between the companies abroad or understanding a lot of what they do abroad, it's very useful to look at what they do at home. You know, at home, there's lots of competition for market share, and that also impacts what the companies do abroad. You know, why is China National Petroleum Corporation, you know, building certain refineries in Guangdong province? And again, it's competition with Sinopec for market share. And if you look at, you know, the Turkmenistan-China natural gas pipeline and why was that built so quickly, and a lot of it, again, had to do with competition on the part of CNPC with both Sinopec and Sinopec, you know, for market share in Guangdong province. And there was a sense the faster we can get the pipeline there, then the less market share we'll lose to Sinopec that's been rapidly building liquefied natural gas terminals. You know, and there are instances of the companies competing abroad about company, you know, there have been cases where the companies have bid against each other. You know, I heard a number of years ago from an energy official in China that they don't always like it when the companies compete, and that if you have two companies that want to compete for the same asset, especially if it's not being auctioned off in an open auction, if it's sort of a bilateral deal type thing, that this person did tell me that they basically try to get one company to back off. So I think, I guess to answer your question, I think you probably do have different companies that have different types of access and different relationships, but I don't have any concrete examples that I can give you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I really don't have much to add to that as far as energy is concerned. I think there's also competition between resources, just to get the ear of the leaders among the different vital resources. So though there's competition within the energy, like Erica was talking about, there's also then competition between the various mineral companies and then the energy companies.
Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Thank you all for a very interesting discussion of the issues. It struck me, and Linda especially directed at you, that there have been two dramatic downturns in the U.S.-China relationship in 2009 and this year. Attach one to the impeccable episode, the confrontation in the South China Sea, and the other with the Taiwan arms announcement. Yet it seems to me in both cases that there has been a dramatic reversal, and they started making nice again. It seems to me that that happened when these issues came to the attention of the most senior leadership, and we were looking at the G20 meeting and some important things the U.S. and China had to do, and so someone said, knock it off in the South China Sea, and it looks like to me that maybe that same thing is happening now as we prepare for the summit. So it makes me ask the question, what's the role of Hu Jintao or someone else as he looks around at these new players and is in these cases of these examples of his having bridled in people that you talked about at length?
Yes, thank you. Perhaps I would say when things were getting out of hand, that's when I don't necessarily think that it caught the attention of the senior leadership, because I think the senior leadership does follow very closely the U.S.-China relationship at all times. But when things seem as if they were getting out of hand, as was the case in both the instances that you mentioned, that's when I think the senior leadership would step in. I just want to underline these are speculative comments, like we've all now said, we know so little about the details of decision-making. But the role of Hu Jintao in all of the over 70 interviews that I did in China for this report, everyone agreed that the role of Hu Jintao is pivotal in any major foreign policy decision-making, and especially anything to do with U.S.-China. So, yes, I do think that Hu Jintao's voice is listened to. I think, of course, he's the target of intense lobbying by all of these groups in any which way that they can get access and try and influence him.
Okay, in the back.
Hi, Charles Loy. I'm an intern here at CSAS. Just a really broad question. Can you guys talk a little bit about the influence that foreign corporations may or may not have on foreign policy within China?
Foreign corporations, who would like to comment on that?
This is a question that actually came up for a follow-up study that I did on this report for Europeans in specific, specifically Europeans, and the question of foreign corporations. Generally speaking, foreign corporations feel that they should not band together with Chinese corporations, even on issues which might interest internationally oriented Chinese corporations. For example, the recent draft rules on innovation and indigenous innovation in particular. There was intense lobbying on the Chinese government. There were three different entities within the Chinese government who signed those draft rules. Internationally oriented Chinese companies opposed these rules, and so did foreign entities. But foreign companies did not see that it would be a good idea to link together with the Chinese companies, because they could easily be branded as, well, it's the foreigners again meddling in the domestic affairs of China. So they both lobbied successfully, I might add, independently, and they did have an effect. These draft rules were then amended. So that's just a case study of how foreign companies can get their voice heard when it's when they join together, the Europeans and Americans especially, and oppose something. Otherwise, their influence, it has to be a particular case which has to do with their interests on commercial issues. I wouldn't say that, generally speaking, foreign companies have much influence in foreign policy decision-making.
In the back on the right.
Hey, my name is John. I'm from the Helsinki Commission. And my question goes to the Chinese energy companies, actually. So when they enter a region where there are visible economic and but also political tensions, my question is there any leeway that these companies have, knowing that they enter this region in hopes that Beijing will back them up? So for them, it is sort of an intentional conflict, but then back in Beijing, to them, it could be interpreted as unintentional.
I guess I wouldn't be surprised if the companies, because they are state-owned companies, because they have access to the leadership, if there is a hope that there will be political support. I think I've seen some comments made about that over the years. But I also think that the companies, again, the issue that I think Dave and Linda were talking about events on the ground, getting ahead of foreign policy, I think we've sort of seen that in some of the situations that the companies have found themselves in. For example, a lot of Chinese energy company workers have been kidnapped in places like Sudan and places like Eritrea. And I've heard, from colleagues in Beijing that this is a new issue, and how do you negotiate with kidnappers, and do you pay them off or do you not pay them off? And, and I guess getting to another actor in the foreign policy process, netizens have gotten involved, that when the Chinese oil workers were kidnapped in Eritrea a number of years ago, you had sort of lots of postings, which I think the government required them to eventually take down, saying, where is the government? Why aren't they stepping in? Why isn't anybody sort of, taking more actions abroad to help get our citizens back? And I think those were quickly taken down. So I think that there's an expectation of support in some cases, but that in other cases, we see that the government isn't necessarily able to react as much as the companies would like. And sometimes, I guess also on the government company issue, I think in some cases the companies, and again, I think you have to look at this on a case-by-case basis and look at the company and look at their relationship to the government and what other foreign policy issues are at play and the government's view on them. I think in some cases, you know, the companies have been able to get the government to support them. You know, for example, in Kazakhstan, a lot of support has been given by the government to the companies to help get them finalize deals. In other cases, you know, going back to Sinok Unical, Fu Chengyu, who was the head of the company at the time that that bid was made, sort of complained bitterly to the Chinese media afterwards that he just did not get the support he wanted, that he said, you know, at the time this deal was going down, there were a whole bunch of other issues at play in the China-U.S. relationship. Boeing wanted to sail airplanes to the United States. You know, Washington was looking for more support from Beijing on the six-party talks. You know, there were currency tensions. You know, why didn't anybody, nobody stepped in to help. Nobody sort of made a linkage between our bid and, you know, these issues. And putting aside whether this would have, you know, played well at all in the United States, you know, it's sort of consistent what I've heard from other people that despite the fact that Sinok and the MFA are, you know, sort of right across the street from each other in Beijing, there really was a lack of communication. So I think it's sort of hard to answer in general that there are, you know, you really have to look case by case.
Over here.
Thank you. I'm Bing Wu Wang with Chinese MediaNet. Thank you for the panelists mentioned our Chinese press as a new actor in Chinese foreign policy. And my question is, this week, China just successfully launched the satellite Chang'e 2 to the space. And I wonder if China is taking a step ahead in space race. Could this be a new factor in Chinese foreign policy, and would the U.S. consider this as a new China threat scenario? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not sure that I subscribe to the idea that there's a space race, so I'm not comfortable with the way that the question was couched. I think China's civilian and commercial space program is an open book. I think everybody knows what the Chinese are up to. Their plans to land a probe on the moon is quite public. They're proceeding with everything they plan to do. So I don't think that that people should be all that concerned about that. Where there is concern in the U.S. about China's activities in space is in the past when China had the anti-satellite test. It inadvertently created the world's largest space debris junkyard, which didn't sit well with others. And, of course, the fact that they have programs at all that send weapons into space is not very comforting in some quarters. But the fact that the Chang'e is launched on National Day and it goes up and it continues with its space exploration in itself is not necessarily, I think, an issue of particular concern.
I would also add that last November, when President Obama visited China, in the joint statement that was signed between the two presidents, U.S.-Chinese space cooperation was among the areas that were listed for potential cooperation. So
that actually went back to Michael Griffin, administrator of NASA during the Bush administration, actually made a couple of visits to Chinese counterparts at China's space agency.
In the back on the right.
Dan Harnett, staffer of the U.S. China Commission. Dave, is it proper to really be saying the PLA is...
Can you hold that closer to your mouth? I'm having trouble hearing you.
No, I speak quite loudly. Dave, is it quite possible that we're actually looking at the PLA as one entity when it really might be more than one entity, as one policy actor? So maybe the Navy versus the Air Force, the four general departments, they each have their own interests. Is it more correct maybe look at them as multiple policy actors or influences on foreign policy?
Yeah, Dan, to tell you the truth, by the way, Dan wrote a tremendous paper a few years ago on China's new historic missions for the PLA. Thanks for that. I don't know, Dan. I mean, you know, it's first of all, it's tempting to view the PLA as a unitary actor. In some cases, it probably is acting as a unitary actor. In other cases, it's acting as a bureaucratic actor. When the two are acting in different ways, I just don't have any visibility at the moment. So, and it's not necessarily clear that everybody in the PLA agrees with some of the commentary that's been in the public by some people in the PLA. And I think Linda has had some some anecdotal evidence of that. So I don't believe the PLA is lockstep, a unitary actor, that there aren't pockets of disagreement or different views throughout it. What I can't figure out is, when is it acting as a unitary actor, and when is the bureaucratic actor model operative at the national policy-making level? Not very helpful, I'm afraid.
Susan Lawrence.
Susan Lawrence with the Congressional Research Service. I had some questions about the maritime disputes that have got China into a lot of hot water with the United States and with its neighbors. One question is about the role of the Fisheries Commission as another actor. I mean, it seems that the Fisheries Commission has been quite assertive in trying to, well, I guess in its sense of what its role should be and perhaps in its definition of what China's territory encompasses, but things that the Fisheries Commission does certainly push Chinese foreign policy. I mean, when they capture boats and they you know, do aggressive things in the South China Sea, that forces the foreign policy apparatus to respond. And then related to that, I guess, I mean, another maritime dispute, the Senkakus, I was just, again, curious for your comments on the role of the PLA in responding to, well, actually, sorry, Senkakus, I guess, is the foreign ministry's responding to that. Sorry, I'm thinking more about the military exercises in response to the Chonan, the U.S. ROK military exercises in response to the Chonan. The PLA reacted very vociferously, or PLA commentators reacted very vociferously to those exercises and seemed to be pushing the foreign ministry to react very strongly too. And again, I wondered sort of what your senses of how the PLA was playing that.
On the first part of that question, I will add a piece, and then I think Dave Finkelstein will address it. I'm curious how you would see in the role of the fisheries, to what extent it is independent and to what extent it is directed.
Yeah, I don't know that I can answer the second part with any high level of fidelity, Bonnie, but here's something I would say is that, thank you for raising that, because Chinese maritime policy should probably be the poster child case study for Linda's assertion of fractured authority. We recently did some work at Center for Naval Analyses on this issue, and we came to find out that there are at least 12 ministries that have a stakeholder dog in that maritime fight. So 12 ministries. Within the PLA itself, we found 8 separate departments at the national level that have a piece of maritime policy making. There are 6 maritime law enforcement agencies that have a law enforcement dog in that fight, and that's before you even start talking about the provincial level and coastal, littoral, provincial governments. So here's a case where you really do have a fractured foreign policy-making process, and all of these entities are complaining to Beijing that there is no one entity at the center that has overarching control over China's maritime policy. So classic case study. Now, the implication of that for U.S. national policymakers is that it's not just the PLA Navy you need to be talking to. So if countries have problems with China's maritime policies, you really do have to take a whole-of-government approach to talking to the Chinese government. Now, on the issue of U.S. exercises in the Yellow Sea, it's not necessarily clear to me that the PLA was by itself in voicing its concern about the proximity of those exercises to China's coast. And except for Ma Xiaoqian, and correct me if I'm wrong, anybody and everybody, I think Ma Xiaoqian was probably the only real official PLA person to say something official about those exercises. I don't consider Luo Yan necessarily or the others who were in the media necessarily representing a unified PLA position. That's something that's up for grabs and argument. But Ma Xiaoqian did say it. And it's not necessarily clear to me that he could say something like that without the modicum of coordination at some level. If I'm wrong, I need to be shown that I'm wrong, because that's a critically important point of analysis.
But it was interesting that after Ma Xiaotian made his statement on Phoenix TV on July 1st, that the language that was then used by the foreign ministry was much tougher than it had been initially in response to the statement by the actually the South Korean defense minister that there would be an exercise with the George Washington, the Yellow Sea, which has still not materialized. Linda, you wanted to add to that?
Well, actually, Dave already said the main point about this multiple amount of agencies who have some kind of say in maritime affairs. And I'd just like to add about the Fisheries Commission. I mean, if this report hadn't now come out, I would have probably put them as one actor. I've been looking at China's evolving policy on the Arctic. And there, too, the Fisheries Commission is being extremely assertive. In demanding, among others, that there has to be a holistic approach to maritime affairs, that China needs one, and there should be one overarching agency. But as, for example, Erica has written about the energy sector, this is quite typical. Within the NDRC, Erica has written, there are departments who have overlapping jurisdiction over the same issue to do with energy security. So this is just one more example of it.
Over here.
My name's Grant Hogan. I'm interning here at the Energy and National Security Program. Ms. Jacobson, I really enjoyed your presentation just on the different actors in foreign policy, and it made me think of what would the implications of that be on the current issues regarding rare earth policy within the U.S., that them having 97% of the access, but thinking of having the energy and energy technology companies having such a say. I guess any of you might be able to answer it. How do you see the dynamics of that coming up in terms of foreign policy, foreign trade?
I can try. It's a great question. I mean, it's a little different in the sense that here we're dealing with exports rather than imports. And so then the question is, you know, are there certain, rare earth companies in China, whose corporate interest, I suspect whose corporate interests might be differently impacted by, for example, the government's, plans earlier this year to reduce the amount of rare earths that were exported, because not all, I think there are 17 different rare earths. Some are more rare than others. And so, depending on what the companies produce, there might be some companies who would prefer actually to export more, maybe if you have the rarer ones, because there might be a higher price. And then the other issue, I guess, for Chinese companies, if you look at this decision, is I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, even though right now, China, I think, basically dominates the production of rare earths to the tune of, 90-97%. However, rare earths, that doesn't mean that China controls 97% of the reserves. But I think most studies show that China controls about one-third of the rare earth deposits in the world. And so I think a lot of commentators have been saying that one impact of this sort of the reduction in rare earth exports, which, we knew about, at the beginning of the year, combined with what recently happened with Japan and the issue of was there sort of an informal ban on rare earth exports to Japan, that I suspect this is going to spur, production of rare earths around the world. Australia has a lot. The U.S. has a lot. And so if that happens, that might, negatively impact Chinese firms, because that might, if there's more production, then we might see prices going down. So it's a somewhat different dynamic, and these are just some of the issues that I would look at.
Since we haven't had a question on public opinion, I think I'd like to ask Linda a bit about this. In your conversations and interviews in China, how do you understand that public opinion is tracked and monitored? Is there internal polling that's conducted? Is there monitoring of the internet and of blogs? And if so, by whom? Does the leadership ask to be briefed about the public opinion or reaction to specific issues before they respond and formulate their policies? And even if you just have an anecdotal sense, I'd be curious about how you would view this issue.
Thank you for asking that. Public opinion is monitored and tracked extensively by various authorities in China. Xinhua every morning produces a one-sheet paper for the expanded Politburo members of what are the main topics on the most popular foreign policy blogs. There's about six of them. I think they're mentioned in a footnote in the report. So that's at the very top. But in addition, about 18 to 24 months ago, the official information office of China set up what they call a keyword section. Now, this is not the kind of keyword section that they're trying to put a keyword in and stop you from using the internet. They also have that in China. That's more the censorship side. They're tracking what words come up. There are about 11 people working in this section, and their full-time job is to figure out what is being discussed in the realm of foreign policy and international affairs. And this is I've visited the section. They talk about their work quite openly. There are numerous ways that the officials, every ministry is trying to also track what are the big issues. Scholars that many of us associate ourselves with are asked in as consultants. How should we, for example, teach Chinese journalists to write in a more constructive way about U.S. and China relations so that misunderstandings don't occur? There's a story about that, for example, in the report, how one of the interviewees said, yes, I think the Chinese government is doing quite a good job about steering public opinion. I'm one of their advisors. So, yes, there is an immense amount of effort put into that. Then, of course, then there's the five Mao citizens who are allegedly paid five Mao. We don't know this. This is kind of now become standard practice to talk about the five Mao army, but they're citizens who are recruited by the authorities to monitor what is going on the blog sites, and if it really gets out of hand, to give a certain phone number call so that that blog site is shut down. But more often, it's that person will then insert themselves into the discussion on the website and try and steer the discussion in a way that would be more favorable to the government's position on whatever issue is at stake. And lastly, I'll just mention that... I lost my thought here. Sorry.
David, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, just a couple of factoids on the military side. The PLA is very concerned about how the Chinese citizens view its own military. And about 5 or 6, 7 years ago, there was a lot of concern that you had with the proliferation of Xiaobao, small newspapers, out in the provinces. You had a lot of reporters who were either hyperinflating PLA capabilities or totally denigrating PLA capabilities because these people knew nothing about military issues. And so they worked with the Central Committee's Propaganda Department, or Publicity Department, as they call it now, to have regulations put in place that nobody could report in the provinces on military issues without first being trained by the GPD, the General Political Department's Propaganda Department. And of course, there is in Xinhua, all your military reporting on military affairs out of Xinhua is done by military officers. There is a section of 50 people that are inserted into Xinhua headquarters and also out in the provinces who are actually active duty uniformed people. So whatever you're reading in Xinhua about the PLA is actually done mostly by the GPD's propaganda department, their military journalists.
And Linda has remembered her final anecdote.
Sorry, it's so cold up here that my brain is freezing too.
You're from Scandinavia. What are you talking about?
I live in Beijing. Many interviewees who deal with this question that Bonnie asked about said that the leaders aren't really that interested if there are a diverse number of opinions on a crisis situation. That's okay, but when overwhelmingly the tide is turning towards a certain opinion, especially if it's negative of how the leadership has handled the issue, but even if it's positive, that's when they pay attention, and that's what the reason why they monitor so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has really been a fascinating event, and I want to thank Linda Jacobson, Dave Finkelstein, and Erica Downs, and all of you for coming today. And again, my apologies for our lack of chairs, and when our new building is constructed, we have bigger conference rooms, we will have more chairs and bigger rooms. Please join me in thanking our speakers.